Support for this episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere is made possible by the Wessex Express, the premier publisher of books about Sherlock Holmes and his world. Find them online at wessexpress.com.
I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, episode 175, Building an Archive.
I hear of Sherlock everywhere since you became astronomer.
In a world where it's always 1895, comes I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, a podcast for devotees of Mr. Sherlock Holmes, the world's first unofficial consulting detective.
I've heard of you before. You're Holmes the meddler, Holmes the busybody, Holmes the Scotland Yard jack in office.
The game's afoot as we discuss goings-on in the world of Sherlock Holmes enthusiasts, the Bigger Street irregulars, and popular culture related to the great detective.
As we go to press, sensational developments have been reported.
So join your hosts, Scott Monty and Burke Wolder, as they talk about what's new in the world of Sherlock Holmes.
You couldn't have come at a better time!
Well, hello. Welcome once again to I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast for Sherlock Holmes devotees where it's always 1895. I'm Scott Monty.
I'm Burt Wolder.
And this is the live version, not the archival version of myself. What about you, Burt?
Oh, I'm completely restored. I have a new binding and new end papers. And wait a minute, if I get up, you'll be able to see them.
Wow. So had you cracked your spine before? Is that what happened?
Oh, no. It's just shelf wear.
Well, my dust jacket is going. So it's chipped in a number of places.
You know, I enjoy wearing my dust jacket, but it always makes me sneeze.
Well, if you would like to get the show notes for this episode, they are available at ihose.co/ihose175. Which corresponds to the appropriate page on ihearofsherlock.com. There you can leave us a comment. You can get in touch with us in all of our social networking guises, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. We are I Hear of Sherlock in all of those places. You can email us, comment at ihearofsherlock.com. You can, reach out to us on Patreon and PayPal and help us reach our $100 goal to fund transcripts for every episode. We would love to be able to fund the transcripts moving forward and to begin going back through past episodes, but we do need financial support to make that happen. And finally, you can reach us on the phone, area code 774-221-READ. That's 774-221-7323. And believe it or not, we actually had someone that dialed us up last time. So let's take a listen.
Hi, guys. It's John Guillen calling from Queenswell, Ontario, Canada. I won the canonical couplet on June 15th, I believe it was. I just got my prize in the mail. Thank you, guys. The Adventure of the Cheesemonger's Bark. I am just flabbergasted. This is wonderful. I will now spend the rest of the day looking this up. I had never even heard of this. This is just great. Thanks, guys. And again, best Sherlockian podcast in the world. Take care.
Well, that's great. Thank you so much for calling. It's great to hear you.
Yeah. Thanks so much, John. And if you would like a Sherlockian prize, something we can't necessarily promise it's just something as rare as The Adventure of the Cheesemonger's Bark by John Royle, we will give you an opportunity to do that toward the end of the show, so make sure you stay tuned in. And right now, we are pleased to welcome Glenn Moranker and Ross Davies, both members of the Baker Street Irregulars, to talk with us about an upcoming symposium and exhibition. So let's get to it. Well, it's our pleasure to welcome two alumni guests to the show, Glenn Moranker and Ross Davies. You may remember them having been on our show previously. I think most recently, Ross joined us on episode 137, talking about boxes from royalty. We talked about some of those gift boxes that soldiers might receive in World War II and, excuse me, World War I. And Glenn has been with us, oh boy, I want to say three shows, somewhere around there, Glenn. You're really an old hand at this point.
I can't help you because I don't keep track. I just remember them all fondly.
You were with us. Actually, you win the prize for the most recent guest. You were with us for Deadly Harpoon, episode 162. Oh, yes. We talked about the Black Peter manuscript. You were with us talking about the Sherlock Holmes collection, Dan's auction. A couple of years ago, that was episode 133, and then originally as episode 79, where we talked about your collection. So we've come full circle.
There you go. Yes.
Well, and the reason
I'm always pleased to talk to you, you and Mr. Walder.
Excellent.
Yes. We should be putting out a Maranker boxed set.
Just call my agent and he'll negotiate residuals and stuff.
Excellent. Well, the royalties are severe around here, so be prepared. you know, I know we've created playlists on SoundCloud and Spotify for our Trifles podcast. We could probably do the same with groups of interviews here, no question. Well, let's talk a little bit about why we're here. There is an event coming up in November, first full weekend in November, I believe, the 8th through the 10th of November in Indiana, specifically at the University of Indiana at Bloomington, and it's called Building an Archive, a celebration of the arrival of the BSI Archive at the Lilly Library. So why don't we back up a little bit and first inform people about the Lilly Library. What is it and why should we care?
Well, the Lilly Library is one of the great reference libraries, not only in the United States, but on this planet. And it was assembled, funded by Richard, let me double check the name out, not Eli Lilly. Eli Lilly was the father of the fellow who built the library, and also a substantial funder of IU. But his son was a unrivaled collector of books. He was methodical. He was academic. He assembled enormous information about the items he found, where they were found, why they were important. And the Lilly Library was built on the shoulders, so to speak, of his collection and his collection passion and his collection skill.
Well, I guess that goes to show there's great money in drugs.
Yes, even before opioids.
And if I may add, correct me if I'm wrong on this, Glenn, but one of the things that Lilly was renowned for, even among collectors, was his commitment to the collector's commitment to condition. He not only collected great works, but he collected the finest available versions of those great works. So to the extent that a book is, yes, in part it's the text that is in the book, but it is also a work of art and sometimes a historical artifact. His collection was filled with the best of the work of art and the artifact aspects of these things as well.
Hmm. No, you're absolutely right. And a point that I like to make is that not obviously or ironically, I don't know what to call it, the text in a book is very rarely what makes it interesting. It is as a collectible, as an artifact. There are some important counterexamples to that, you know, like the Shakespeare folios, where one book is not like the other. The publishers and printers took liberties with the source material. But by and large, what makes a book interesting is all the things about a book that are the result of it being an artifact that was created by a community. We shouldn't forget that authors don't write books and printers don't print books. Authors write manuscripts or typescripts or Word files. And there's a large community between that initial collection of ideas, that initial synthesis of ideas. There's a large group there's a whole ecosystem between those words and what eventually ends up in the reader's hands. And so there's an unbelievably long-winded way of saying that having examples of an artifact that are extraordinary in relevant ways, such as conditions, such as provenance, who owned them, who studied the books, is absolutely critical. And Lilly absolutely understood this.
Well, quick look at the library's website. 450,000 books, 8.5 million manuscripts, 60,000 comic books, 16,000 mini books, 35,000 puzzles, and 150,000 pieces of sheet music. That is quite the collection. And I'll tell you what, I bet that books and works about Sherlock Holmes fit into every one of those categories, unequivocally.
Well, without a doubt. And J.K., by the way, J.K. Lilly, one of the books you'll have the opportunity to see, had several classic Sherlockian books inscribed to him by some of the, shall we say, founding fathers of BSI. But I'm not going to say any more than that. You'll have to go to the exhibition to see them.
Oh, I see what you're doing there.
Yes, it's not the last time you've heard that line.
Actually, I must say, who knows where or what my expectations came from or exactly what they were. But as I was reviewing materials for the exhibition, when I came across these books that had been owned by Mr. Lilly Jr., and they had more than a casual connection to the Baker Street Irregulars, I was delighted and dumbfounded at both at the same time.
Mm. Well, and that's a frequent condition for me, so I can understand why that's appealing. Talk a little bit about the character of the Lilly, because, you know, one of the things that great institutions have is different approaches in dealing with people who would like to visit the collection. Many institutions are scant of resource. They have more items and articles than they can really comfortably manage themselves. They require a lot of advanced preparation for a visit. But Lilly has struck me in my visit there last year as being extraordinarily friendly and welcoming and open. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, the character of Lilly?
Maybe I could start with an anecdote from the Sherlockians' visit to the Lilly last summer as part of Gillette to Brett, Steve Doyle and Mark Gagan's event last summer. The Lilly had an exhibition set up just for us, a smaller scale exhibition, and not purely Sherlockian then. But it was very nice, very well arranged. And one of the books on display was the copy of the first volume of U.S. statutes, laws passed by the United States Congress, given to Thomas Jefferson, then Secretary of State, by George Washington, then President of the United States. And in my spare time, when I'm not entangled with Sherlock Holmes, I'm a lawyer. And this volume had a couple of interesting features of the very sort that Glenn was talking about, things that are not about the text, that are about the work that is the final created published work and how it had been marked in by Thomas Jefferson. And I said to one of the Lilly folks, I would be grateful for an image or permission to snap a quick photo of just this one page of this book. And this Lilly assistant librarian said, why don't you let me take care of that for you, and I'll get back to you in a few days. And I said, thank you. And I expect, you know, in a few days, I'd get a form that I would fill out requesting that a document be provided to me at some point. And instead, what I got was a link to a high resolution scan of the entire book.
Wow.
And I think that speaks to A, the resources they have,
and
B, how they deploy those resources, which is they love working with people who love what they have. And for a legal scholar, it was pretty close to a tear-jerking experience. You just don't get treated that way, particularly by people who don't know you.
It's no LexisNexis.
In the institutions, at least superficially, like the Lilly, that is, they have large and, in some reasonable sense, spectacular collections of books and archives and so forth. In my view, all of them fall someplace on this spectrum that on the good side is a library and on the bad side is a book museum. And by book museum, I mean an institution which has these things and their mission in life is to preserve them for all time at the cost of anything. And a library is a place which celebrates the books, makes their content, their importance readily and fairly easily available. I won't speak about book museums because it's uncharitable, but I will say that my two favorite places, my two favorite examples of what I consider, exemplary libraries are the Lilly and the Ransom Library in Texas. They both, use their collections for the benefit of people. And if you have the need for their assistance or their materials, they cannot do enough to be helpful.
Back on episode 53, we talked with Tom Francis, who was then the chair of the BSI Trust, about the establishment of the trust and it then being housed at the Houghton Library at Harvard. Can you share with us the journey of how the BSI came to the conclusion that the collection needed to be rehoused and how Lilly was put at the top of the list there?
Yeah, and let me add to that, as you do it, for some of our listeners who are not deeply into the machinations of a literary society like the Baker Street Irregulars, they might be sitting there thinking, well, gee, what is this anyway? This is probably what, a bunch of cocktail napkins and some menus. And so talk a little bit, too, about the scope of the collection and its importance.
Okay, two rather different questions, I think. I don't think it would be appropriate for me to comment on the leaving of the archive from the Houghton. There were some, differences, and thanks to the, great good works of the Trust Board and Mike Whalen, a spectacular new home was found. And as far as your comment, there was a nugget in your comment, which, if expanded upon, says much of it. And that is the BSI is fundamentally a literary organization. It has always had a strong literary bent, and the consequences of that, the manifestations of that, is that both the members who may not be professionals, so to speak, and some other members who may be professionals have produced an enormous body of literature, much of it related to Sherlock Holmes and some of it not. So just a few examples. Isaac Asimov was a member of the BSI, and he has no shortage of Sherlock and Baker Street Irregular focused publications, but to make a silly understatement, his output, his writing output, the number of books that he wrote and the number of topics he covered is spectacular. And those sorts of things are properly in the archive. He was BSI. after all. Another example is Nick Myers, who did the 7% solution and Canary Trainer and Lord only knows how many movies he's either written or directed. So again, a BSI and a substantial contributor to literature writ large, both Sherlockian and non-Sherlockian. So I would argue that this makes a very strong case for following the or preserving and celebrating the history of the Baker Street Irregulars, both their lives and direct actions around the subject nearest and dearest to our hearts, and their lives and the topics that were the day jobs of the men and women who made up the Baker Street Irregulars.
So as you think about bringing people to a gathering like this event in Indiana that's happening November 8th through the 10th, and as you showcase certain elements of the collection, I mean, part of the challenge of any curator is knowing what not to include, I would think. There is only so much table space and floor space around an exhibition hall that one can dedicate to these items. And, you know, whether you're doing a massive exhibition on the radio scripts of Orson Welles' Mercury Theater or a version of Gutenberg's Bible, say the New Testament from Gutenberg's Bible, you need to tell a story. You need to effectively tell a story and bring people emotionally through this journey. So talk a little bit about how you decided to select and assemble these pieces and what you hope people walk away from this exhibition thinking or feeling.
Ross, do you want to comment on that or shall I?
Oh my gosh.
It's something Ross and I talked about at great length any number of times.
And it is, I'll tell you what, I will open and then Glenn will continue. How's that, Glenn?
Works for me.
When the 221 objects title first circulated among folks thinking about this conference, a couple of people who had not spent much time with the archive or who had not spent much time with Glenn said, "Are you sure there's enough?"
That was our reaction.
Yeah, that's a good one.
Scott, that is the correct response. This is, for me, this has been just a thrilling and sensory overload ride through almost 100 years of this, just the planning for this, of this wonderful community that is that has generated material that would make beautiful and interesting and historically significant sort of classic Victorian volumes of the correspondence between X and Y. It is also a group that has thrown some of the coolest parties in the 20th century. And it is also a group that has an extraordinary history of publishing its own work. And weaving together those things while also somehow sort of giving a sort of a, not a complete, but a reasonably representative account of the diversity of people who've been involved. A couple of these folks Glenn has mentioned. It really has been a difficult challenge in terms of picking the right lengths or the right bits of threads that will weave together a coherent narrative without overwhelming people, without trying to pack too much into what someone could enjoy in one Friday afternoon in November. So that's really, I think, a lot of what our conversations have been about is how to get the right mix of those things, the uh, the internal literary and historical, the social literary and historical, and then the actual sort of conventional publishing productive work. And at that, I turn it over to Glenn, who has probably actually touched more of the irregular history, perhaps, than any person standing on this earth.
Thank you. Be that as it may, I think that's a wonderful summary. You know, we're talking about people who, through their social activities, through their creative writings, have, you know, made at least a small dent in the universe. And what we're after, and I'm not going to say anything new because they're just sort of amplifying Ross's points. But what we hope to do is amplify the breadth, some of the depth, the continuity. The BSI was publishing things from before there was a BSI. BSI members, they were publishing things related to Sherlock and Conan Doyle before there was a BSI, and we continue to do so today. And this is a piece of intellectual continuity which is best if it's understood, appreciated, and celebrated. Now, I want to take strength, as you, for example, have mentioned a couple of times, you know, Orson Welles and the Theater of the Air. That's not the kind of thing we're going to include. As wonderful as those broadcasts were, they don't per se have anything to do with the BSI. And this symposium and this exhibition, you could say, is certainly it's about the BSI, its literary and sodality output, but mostly it's literary output. And it's not directly per se about Sherlock Holmes and the Sherlock stories. That's a wonderful, wonderful topic, but it's not the subject of this exhibit, nor is it the subject of this symposium.
Yeah. And I think that has been a discerning factor of the BSI archive for quite a while. You know, when the archive and trust first landed at the Houghton Library, people said, well, why didn't it go to Minneapolis? You know, we just had the big conference that the Norwegian Explorers put on earlier this month at the University of Minnesota libraries. Of course, the Sherlock Holmes collections bounded, you know, quite fully by John Bennett Shaw's own collection and has grown certainly since then. That's what University of Minnesota is known for. People say, well, why when you moved from Houghton, didn't you go to the University of Minnesota? Well, it's because the BSI archive is not just about Sherlock Holmes. It's specific to the BSI and the BSI's origin stories and growth as a literary society. It's publishing empires, it's events, et cetera. Everything we see happening now with the organization that is almost a throwback to the entire history of the organization. You know, it's being expressed now. And I think having a unique and singular home for the BSI Trust makes a great deal of sense in that perspective.
I mean, certainly Minneapolis is an absolutely spectacular institution, and its Sherlockian bona fides are second to none. You could argue about some that may be equal, but no, none that are better. But how could you possibly do better than the Lilly? The enthusiasm with which we've been met, greeted, continue to be met and greeted, and excellence in terms of scholarship and archival knowledge is not exceeded anywhere. And the other thing, which since we're talking about you mentioned John Bennett Shaw, turns out there are an interesting number of rather high profile Indianans, even Indianapolis Indianans, throughout BSI history. I will only mention two. Elmer Davis and Walter Klinefelter. No more. That's already a spoiler, but there is more. So it's not as if there is none or only a casual connection between the BSI and Sherlock and the Lily.
Mm.
But that's one of the things we trust people will come away with when they view the exhibit and listen to some of the presentations.
People are always impersonating other people in the movies, like the mysterious Major Duncan Bleak in the Rathbone Bruce film Terror by Night. But what if Universal had made one more Sherlock Holmes feature? What if there was one more Basil Rathbone and Nigel Bruce adventure? Now you can find out in the Drury Lane Theater Mystery, an original Sherlock Holmes screen treatment by Dennis Hoey, the actor who starred as Inspector Lestrade in the series. Discovered in a forgotten cache of old Hollywood photographs and studio documents comes this previously unknown screen treatment, a backstage mystery set in London's famous Drury Lane Theater. And it includes additional material by Dennis Hoey's son, Michael, a Hollywood writer, producer, and director. This unique glimpse of the movie that might have been is available right now at WessexPress.com.
Well, it's interesting for, you know, those of our listeners who, you know, might not have been to exhibitions like this. I mean, I just think back on things I've happened to see over the last few years. The Rosenbach in Philadelphia Ed Pettit at the Rosenbach did a lovely exhibition of Dracula. I can't remember the anniversary. Maybe it was 100th anniversary of it had to be more than 100 years of publication. Anyway, it was an opportunity to see Victorian Gothic broadsheets from the era, notes by Bram Stoker as he was writing the story, reviews, just a wonderful collection of artifacts about this particular masterpiece of Gothic literature. And some years ago, the Morgan did a wonderful exhibition on Proust. It was the 100th anniversary of Swan's Way, and you got to see Marcel's notebooks. You know, this tiny, crabby little hand and microscopic text. And you mentioned, you know, that Isaac Asimov's material are part of the archive. And including, we know, because we've talked about it in the past, letters from greats like Franklin Roosevelt to the leaders of the Baker Street Irregulars and so on. And the society goes back to Chris Morley. But at its heart, the BSI archive, you know, is, as you point out, is a collection of what interesting people have done over a very long time because of their enthusiasm and insights about this literature. And I think probably, you know, why people should care about this probably comes down to things like accessibility and access and availability. And while great institutions, you know, like Harvard have a lot of resources, the resources that are available to make this kind of material to come to hand easily, to make it easier to access, you know, we're probably richer at the Lily. So is there anything you could say about the future? You know, what you think is on the horizon for access to materials and making it easier for people to reach some of this stuff?
Well, I think I would like to leave that to the exhibit symposium, where there are going to be a number of presentations, both by the trust people and by the Lily folks about exactly that topic.
Oh, good. Good.
Yeah. I think Glenn's right on that. Just to give you a tiny bit of a non-spoiler preview of that. One of the presentations we're going to have is going to be on exactly how this kind of archiving work gets done. And Erica Dowell, who's one of the key figures at the Lily, is going to be giving a presentation on the working title of which, at least, is Accessing the BSI Archive, How Archiving Actually Works at the Lily. And so we're going to get a little lesson that I think will be of interest to anyone who's interested in how archives and world-class libraries work, and also who has an interest in making good use of the BSI archive. And then later on, we're going to have a panel that, in fact, is titled, Where Are We Going? the future of the BSI archive. And the people who are scheduled to sit on that panel are Mike Whalen, Michael Keen, and Tom Horrocks, which I think is a group that might have some knowledge about where that plan is going.
Yeah. And for folks who aren't familiar with those names, Mike Whalen is the current Wiggins of the Baker Street Irregulars, our current head. Michael Keen is his selected replacement. And Tom Horrocks headed up the Houghton Library at one time and is an expert on conservation and collecting and curation and whatnot. So
and by the way, Scott, the acting head of the BSI Trust Board.
Well, there you go.
There you go.
Learn a little something new every time you tune in here. That's excellent. What else can we expect from the talks portion of the event?
Would you like me to start with what is may well be the most wildly entertaining panel?
Oh, please.
Okay. Oh. The title of this panel is Building a Personal Collection.
Ooh.
And the panelists are Peter Blau, Glenn Merenker, and Nicholas Basbanes.
Oh, my goodness.
I think it's probably fair to say that Peter Blau and Glenn Merenker count as irregulars and collectors, likely to be known to all of our listeners. And Nicholas Basbanes, of course, is the long and well-established scholar of books and book collecting and the author of, among a number of other pretty impressive
Gentle Madness.
Yes.
Gentle Madness is about to have its 25th anniversary, if my memory is correct.
Wow. That's right.
That book is a quarter of a century old.
And it remains not only a great work of scholarship, but a really exciting adventure story for book lovers. If you haven't read A Gentle Madness, you should. And, you know, having Blau, Merenker, and Basbanes on stage talking about and sharing stories about and wisdom about how to build a collection and what's involved and so on, I think will be great fun.
Yeah.
As well as educational.
Well, and to circle this around, I think the sequel to Gentle Madness was Among the Gently Mad, where
yes.
Basbanes continued his narrative about strange people that do strange things in their collecting habits. And one of those people featured in Among the Gently Mad was none other than Dan Poznanski.
There you go.
Oh, Poznanski was in volume one as well.
Oh, he was. Okay.
Yeah.
Can't keep a good man down.
Talk about somebody who has left an imprint on a industry.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
No doubt.
So,
sounds like a great panel to start us out, though.
Yeah.
Well,
speaking of imprints, I suppose it's too much to hope for, but there can't possibly be any new publications or things that people could get if they attend the exhibition, are there?
Oh, that's a real reach, Bert. I guess we'll have to satisfy you with a new BSI Press book by Linda.
Yeah,
and Terry
I suppose. Why don't we do that since Bert brought
okay.
it up? We should have thought of that ourselves.
Darn it! Darn it! So, well, we'll have to hurry up and get that done. Linda and Terry have a new book coming out that is conveniently enough a work of historical scholarship that focuses on the lives and accomplishments of early irregulars and that uses the resources of the BSI archive and numerous other archives. And we're going to have them on stage talking about Sherlockian authors and editors in the archives in the company of Bob Katz, co-publisher of the BSI Press, and Stephen Doyle, whose involvement in irregular publishing goes back, I don't know, to before the flood. And who, in addition to being an accomplished and active publisher, and editor and author, once wrote, and I'm going to quote him from Volume 1, Numbers 3 and 4 of his journal, The Sherlock Holmes Review, in which he wrote, "If one were to attempt to profile the typical Sherlockian, one would quickly realize that the task is impossible. However, one compulsion which nearly every Sherlockian is afflicted to varying degrees is collecting Sherlock Holmes." So we'll have Steve, collector, editor, author, Bob Katz, collector, editor, author, and Linda and Terry Hunt, editors, collectors, authors, and authors of a brand new BSI Press book. Satisfied, Bert?
Oh, well, all right. I guess I better go then.
Now, and if you don't attend, you're not allowed to buy the book.
Oh,
so you'll get one of those, you know, those stamps, like when you went to rock concerts, they stamp you on the back of your hand. If you don't have one of those stamps, we won't let you have one of the books.
Well, this is interesting because it parallels what happened on March 31st, 1944 at the Trilogy Dinner. There were three books that were debuted that evening, and they were The Misadventures of Sherlock Holmes, Profiles in Gaslight, and, oh my goodness, what was the third book? Help me out, Glenn.
Come on, no. I want to see it. You can squirm a little
bit.
Was
it 221B, or was that 1940?
Yes. No, 221B.
It was 221B, okay. And yes, you could find copies of those books later on, but now for the collector, to find a book that was actually printed and handed out at the Trilogy Dinner is a wonderful rarity. And, you know, you think about these books that are being published for the Building and Archive Conference in November, same kind of thing. So get in on the ground floor.
Right on.
Well, it's also, by the way, again, Monty, you're right on the money. One of the other things that Ross and I quickly decided on, we've mentioned some limitations, criteria for not allowing things into the exhibit. And the things we've shared with you reduced it from a totally hopeless task to an unbelievably difficult task. But some of the other things that some of the, if you will, the positive things or inclusive things or reasons to be there is, we wanted things also that were, either historically or visually compelling things that people may not have, had the opportunity to see before.
That's a good distinction.
So things like, hypothetically, a Trilogy Dinner book, which is, if there were Trilogy Dinner books at the exhibit, they would be books that were actually passed out. Remember, the Trilogy Dinner was a celebration of the publication of three titles by three different publishers, all Sherlockian books.
Mm-hmm.
And those books were produced in modest volumes, modest numbers. Hundreds, maybe thousands, I don't know. But there were only 50 of them that were actually passed out at the dinner.
Right.
And they had special pages tipped in. So they're relatively easy to distinguish. It's a Trilogy Dinner book that was at the Trilogy Dinner versus a Trilogy Dinner book whose publication existence was announced at the Trilogy Dinner.
Right.
So, now, of course, Glenn is speaking purely hypothetically about the possibility that such things exist or that you might have an opportunity to see them on the afternoon of November 8th, 2019.
Ross, this is a hypothetical example.
Yes, I understand.
This is one of 221 hypotheticals.
There you go.
I understand. Well, if folks would like to learn more about this, simply head to bsiarchivelily.org. We'll have a link to that in the show notes. You can find out exactly what to do, where to go, how to sign up. You can sign up for the News from the BSI, which is a new email service that the BSI is putting together. It's available to anyone, not just members of the BSI, and it is designed to update you on things like this, events that come due, new publications, etc. So that is your direct lifeline into the BSI and its activities. Glenn, Ross, any final thoughts before we close out the show?
I think people will find it extremely rewarding to in person view the exhibit and also benefit from the symposium associated with the opening of the exhibit. I know we have some interesting speakers, and overall the tenor of the symposium is going to be fairly open and questions welcome and discussion welcome.
Right on.
Excellent. Well, gentlemen, as always, thank you for spending some valuable time with us and being as informative and entertaining as you possibly can be.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks, Bert.
Oh, thank you.
Scott, Bert, thank you very much. It was a blast again.
Yes, indeed.
Well, that certainly sounds like something that is tempting. I know certainly, Bert, you and I have talked about attending the event, and I think we're very much looking forward to that. But if anything, hopefully we have inspired others based on the teasing that Ross and Glenn were able to hang out there in front of us, both for the talks and for the exhibition itself.
Yeah, well, there's lots of reasons, you know, but if any of our listeners have not gone to a great research institution, you really could do no better than starting at the Lilly. It's a wonderful place, and you'll have a great opportunity to be with a lot of like-minded, interesting people. And it really is a lot of fun.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, that was my first foray to the Lilly when we were at the Gillette Tabret conference. And you know, it's a rather imposing building. It looks a lot like Fort Knox from the outside, and rightfully so. I mean, there are treasures to be guarded inside. And the facility itself, the spaces where the exhibitions take place, there really isn't that much to it. I mean, obviously they must have stacks and stacks underground, but there's not all that much foot space to accommodate a lot of things. So it leaves you wondering, you know, what am I missing here? What else is in these grand holdings that that might come up to see the light of day from time to time?
Well, you know, I thought about that when I was there the last time, and I suggested that it just might be easier for everybody if they just gave me a key. And, you know, nobody wanted to do that.
Well, you know, it's funny because I recently read an article that Rebecca Romney shared in her newsletter. You know, she talks about rare books and things related to the book industry. And one of those articles wondered about what the future of history looks like. And in particular, that they were looking at archivists and their role as we are producing more and more electronic information. You know, how do we retain this? And then how do we make it clear as to what exists and how to display it? And that is certainly a conundrum that many of these educational institutions are going to have to grapple with, particularly with archiving and library science and whatnot. But it also makes me wonder about the future of exhibitions. You know, could the BSI someday do a virtual exhibition? Maybe we could do a version someday that has augmented reality, you know? So you hold up your phone and, you know, you look at the BSI menu from 1940. Well, maybe there's a pop-up there or a video that plays or, you know, something else that augments what it is that you're seeing there. Or if you're doing it at home with virtual reality, being able to step through, you know, into a BSI photo. You know, what if they could three-dimensionalize a BSI photo and you could walk among the members in the photograph? You know, I think the possibilities of archiving in the future and exhibitions in the future are endless.
Oh, yeah. Well, I love all of that. Well, yeah, clearly, with technology, increased bandwidth, miniaturization, more powerful computers, more efficient battery. I mean, all of that, all of those trends are very much aligned with that. That's a great suggestion. I'm sure the future generations will find that will be puzzled. They will say, well, now, wait a minute. Do you mean to tell me there was a time when you had to get in a car or drive or get on a plane and go to, what was the point of that? Why did you need to go to the library?
Right. And as usual, with technological achievements, the BSI will be the last to get there.
Now, look, I mean, I have, and maybe this is just a rumor, but I've heard that we're about to retire the mimeograph machine. And it, look, you know, everything in its time.
Well, what am I going to sniff now? Well, those dulcet tones mean that it is once again time to participate in Canonical Couplets. That's right. This is everyone's favorite Sherlockian quiz game, one that we play here on every episode. And we give you two lines of a poem, a couplet, if you will, and we ask you to determine which Sherlock Holmes story it refers to. And in the last episode, we gave you this. Peculiar troubles rock the Empire's seat when Mycroft condescends on Baker Street. Bert, do you know which Sherlock Holmes story we are referring to?
Yes, I think that was the, that really interesting case about explorations in other countries and the discovery of a spy network based somewhere in the United States led by an actor. I think it was Fred McMurray. Isn't this the case known as the Valley of Fred?
Oh, well, while it does sound like it's a wonderful day in the neighborhood, I unfortunately have to turn you down and say, no, this is, in fact, the Bruce Partington plans.
Oh, my goodness. Well, that was going to be my second suggestion.
Well, it's a good one. Anyway, we had a number of people who contributed correct answers this time around, and we are going to spin the big prize wheel here to see exactly who it is that's going to walk away with a prize. And it looks like it's Mary Miller. Hey, it's been a while. Glad you're back on the board here. And we will send something your way to thank you for participating and being the winner.
Oh, what a good opportunity to go over to the Mary Channel and see what's new.
Well, now we're ready to give you the entry for this episode's Canonical Couplet. Here we go. No need of all that bother with the Kaiser, had Lady Hilda been a trifle wiser. If you think you know the answer to this canonical couplet, jot it down in an email. Put the subject canonical couplet in the subject line. Email it to comment@iHearOfSherlock.com. And if you are among the lucky winners, we will select you for a prize. Good luck. All right. Well, here we are once again. Well, we've got some interesting shows coming up in the next few weeks, Bert, the next couplet of episodes. I won't give anything away right now, but let's just say we are going to be tickled with our guests.
Well, that just puts me in mind of Vincent Price, but that was the tingler, not the tickler.
As long as it wasn't the tinkler.
But it's good to have something to look forward to.
Yes, indeed. Well, you folks have this to look forward to, the end of the episode. So I am the forward-looking Scott Monty.
And I'm looking backwards again to no effect. I'm Bert Wolder.
And together, we say
the games
of
afoot.
the games afoot.
You know, I'm afraid that in the pleasure of this conversation, I'm neglecting business of importance, which awaits me elsewhere.
Thank you for listening. Please be sure to join us again for the next episode of I Hear of Sherlock Everywhere, the first podcast dedicated to Sherlock Holmes.
Goodbye, and good luck, and believe me to be, my dear fellow, very sincerely yours, Sherlock Holmes.